Welcome to the Game Mystery Podcast, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine Adamick is here with her weekly recommendation. Justine, I've got a great interview coming up with Jeffrey Round, but before we do that, let's hear what you've got for us today.
Well, let me talk a little bit about Requeer Tales. You know, I'm one of the partners in that, and I exchanged my time here for some promotion of there. Last week, we came out with Like People in History, the 25th anniversary edition of the Gay American Epic by Felice Vacano. It is one of the greats and probably the start of gay literature. What Requeer Tales is doing is getting out-of-print classic gay fiction from Stonewall to the turn of the century and republishing it in ebook and new print editions for the modern reader. It's a great project, and we're particularly proud of Like People in History.
Well, you should be proud of all the books that you've been doing.
Well, that's true, but we're particularly proud of this one. It is a giant among gay literature.
Yeah, it's a big win for you.
Yeah. So let me tell you about the book I'm reviewing this week.
Okay.
It's called The Cuckoo is a Pretty Bird by L.M. Cryer.
And I want to read that just for the title alone.
That's right. What do you hear? And it's Ted Darling Crime Series, Book 14. It's fine to read as a standalone, and I'll talk more about that, about the series later. So it's a police procedural set in England, and I'm not up to date on all of the acronyms and initials in the English police force or the British police force. So Ted Darling is a DCI, which I believe stands for Detective Chief Investigator. Oh, it could be Detective Chief Inspector. Yeah. Anyway, he is in charge of his own little division. He's answerable to two levels of seniority above that before you get to the big brass. So he's running the special crimes division of the police station. You know, unlike the TV shows with the unlimited budgets and the quick turnaround, he is always dealing with budget shortages and insufficient personnel and the inability to get enough overtime for his officers while he's dealing with these crimes. This is always a theme throughout the series. Makes it a lot more realistic. So cuckooing, are you familiar with the crime of cuckooing?
No, I just assumed it was a bird.
Well, the cuckoo bird lays its eggs in other birds' nests next to the other bird's eggs. And then after the other birds have sat on the eggs and hatched them along with their eggs, the cuckoo comes along and kicks the other birds out of the nest and then takes over the nest for their offspring, which is just horrible.
Horrible. It's kind of smart on the cuckoo's part, but well, yeah, it's a horrible thing to do.
It's a horrible thing. And the crime is equally horrible. What happens is that gangs of thugs, or occasionally just one criminal, takes advantage of a disabled person. So what they do is they befriend the disabled person, lead the disabled person to believe that they are like them, hang out with them. And meanwhile, what they're doing is they're using their apartment, using their finances, you know, taking advantage of the disabled person. And in this case, there's a severely disabled woman whose parents let her live on her own, believing that she's more competent than she is. And she can't hear very well, and she can't speak very well, and she's got limited comprehension. And she has a bunch of criminals who distribute drugs, who hide the drugs in her apartment, take advantage of her in other ways, run the electronic purchases through her finances, and abuse her physically, emotionally. And the book starts with her alone with one of the thugs, and he starts harassing her, and she kills him. And as a sign of just how disabled she is, she sees him sleeping and leaves him there for a week. And when he starts to smell, she just sprinkles more air freshener on him. And it's never very clear just how much he understands. And they have to explain to her several times that she's actually killed him. And then the mystery takes off from there. It's a question of, is she victim or pretending she's a victim, pretending she understands less than she did? And then who the heck the guy is that she's killed, and what the rest of his gang is, and then the larger mystery of getting the drug dealers off the streets. Somebody else turns up dead later. Throughout it all, they're just plugging along.
Ooh, it sounds like, getting in her side of her head there a little bit sounds almost like a psychological thriller to a degree.
Yeah. Well, I'm giving it an intriguing recommendation. There, I kept expecting a surprise twist, and I don't know why. Since I've read the first 13 books in the series. And so I kept expecting that something that we knew was suddenly turned on its head, and the author had, successfully hidden something. But no, there are surprises along the way, but it's good, solid police work. They don't know all the facts, and as they discover the facts and put the pieces together, the reader can put the pieces together. And there are the pieces, while not completely incongruous and something unexpected, they're a surprise nonetheless. It's really a very good, interesting mystery, and it gets the intriguing recommendation.
Sounds like a good one.
Yeah. So Ted Darling is married to Trevor, and he's short, and his last name is Darling, so he gets somewhat harassed, but he responds to it and to all of the other things that, guff that he gets from crime scene people, members of the public, by being exceedingly polite. But underneath that politeness, he is a black belt in martial arts, and he's been trained by special forces, and so he is deadly. His husband, Trevor, is repeatedly upset by the amount of time that Ted has to work and the number of promises that Ted makes and breaks. Trevor is generally an easygoing guy. He's got a less stressful job. He works on motorcycles. He's part owner of a business. And their relationship is, I don't think it's rocky. They fight often, the same fight over and over. But you get the sense that they're going to work it through. And they've got a nice ensemble of police officers in the division. And those are all well-rounded.
Sounds like a good one.
It really is. It's a great series and a great protagonist. Well-written, too.
Anything else?
That's it.
Well, what I'm going to have to tell you to do is, since I've got Jeffrey Round coming up, I want you to just sit back and enjoy the music.
Okay, that'll be fun.
Don't you think I know when you're walking in the streets, when all your come and gather at your feet? Don't you think I know you're a woman of defeat? Don't you think I know? Don't you think I know you're a girl of such device? You keep me on your doorstep when I...
That music clip you just heard was written and sung by today's guest, Jeffrey Round. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you so much, Brad.
It's a pleasure to have you on today. Now, before we begin, I'm going to do something. I'm going to run down your resume. And I say it's impressive. I think if you filled an actual resume out, it would take a couple of pages. But on your resume, I have that you've been a fashion model, an editor, a stage director, co-founder of a theater company, a screenwriter, award-winning film director, singer, musician, composer, poet, and of course, the reason you're on the show, a Lambda Award-winning author of 15 books. So I've got to ask you this question, because it comes up whenever someone goes to a party. If you're at a party and somebody comes up and asks this question, what do you answer? The question is, what do you do?
And there is only one answer. I say, I'm a writer. Because if you take those other things that I have done, they would find a particular place on a timeline. So when I was modeling, I was in my 20s. When I was stage managing and doing the theater, I was mostly in my 30s. But the one thing that I have always done, the through line, has been the writing. It's never stopped since I was a kid.
And what do you think set off that spark?
The spark to write?
Yes.
I don't quite know how to say this that doesn't sound pretentious or strange, but I have always thought I was a writer, even before I could pick up a pencil and put it to paper, or before I knew my alphabet. I felt that I was here to write. And so when that turned out to be the case many, many years later, I thought, okay, I guess that shouldn't be a surprise, because that's what I've always thought. That's what I've always known myself to be.
Well, now, this being a show about books, we are going to talk about your newest novel, Lionshead Revisited, which recently released just the other day. And we're also going to talk about the Dan Sharp series in general. But first, we're going to talk about something that's been keeping you busy over the past year, and that you plan to take a sabbatical over the next year. And this has to do with music. Can you tell us about that?
Music in particular, but also there are some videos that I want to make. The music project that I'm working on has been around a long time. I've been writing songs since I was a teenager, and I would write them and perform them and then put them on paper and then put them aside. And I thought at some point, about 7 years ago, I thought I need to start recording these songs, you know, because one day I won't be here and then there will be no record of them. But it was around that time that my father got very ill and he died. And about a month after that, I made a pilgrimage to our hometown of Sudbury, Ontario, which is midway up Ontario. It's called the Nickel Capital of the World. And he and I were both born there, and I thought this is, you know, a little homage that I can pay to him. But on my way back, I came back via Manitoulin Island, which is the world's largest freshwater island. It's in the middle of Lake Huron. I was doing a bit of mountain climbing, and I fell. I had a nasty fall. I won't say it was bad, because obviously I survived, but I fell on my back. I damaged my neck. I damaged my larynx. And for about a year, I could not speak above a whisper. And I thought, okay, well, there go all the songs, because you're never going to sing them again. For about 2 or 3 years after that, my speaking voice started to come back, but there was no singing. I really couldn't hit and hold a note for you to save my life. But about a year ago, I was in the shower and I thought, well, I wonder if I can sing at all anymore. And I could sing about 3 or 4 notes and that was it. And I thought, well, it's not really good, but at least it's something encouraging after the fall that 5 years earlier. So I worked on it. I had a bit of some vocal exercises were given to me, and I started practicing and practicing and practicing, which is what you do. And my voice started to come back. It's now very different from what it was before I fell. But at least it's an acceptable voice. I'm pleased with what it sounds like, even though it's quite different from what it was. So at that point, I went to a music producer and said, look, here's the situation. I've got all these songs and I want to record them. I don't have a voice that's particularly strong at this point in my life, but I would like to make documents of the songs. I also have another friend who I write songs for regularly. She's an operatically trained singer named Lila Kanya. And so I wrote some songs for her, and we I could easily play guitar and piano. I just couldn't sing. So she sang the songs. But I still wanted to put my songs, my voice on certain of the songs that I literally wrote for myself. So slowly I've been starting those. And this is the year that I want to put the major drive on that and see if I can get as many of them as I can while I'm still able to do it. So that this year has been designated for that, and particularly because I don't have any writing projects that are that have immediate deadlines, as I've had pretty much for the last 8 years with the Dan Sharp books. This year I don't have that, so I thought, no, this is the year to do that.
Well, that's pretty impressive to get your voice back at least partially after a mountain climbing accident. And with even though you don't get paid, I'm going to add the mountain climbing to your resume because that is incredibly impressive amongst everything else that you do. You seem like a man that doesn't get bored.
I don't know how.
So let's get to your novel writing. Sure. And you have many accolades, and I'm going to give just a couple of them here. Endgame, a standalone mystery, was called, and I got to say I love this, a brilliant recreation of Agatha Christie's best-selling And Then There Were None, giving the original what one critic called a punk rock reboot. It became your publisher's best-selling ebook in the U.S. in 2016. And then your first novel, A Cage in Bones, of Bones, and your first Bradford Fairfax mystery were listed on After Elton's Top 100 Greatest Gay Books in 2008. And the list goes on from there. It would take the whole show for me to continue. So it's pretty impressive. So let's start with your Lambda Award-winning Dan Sharp series. Tell us who Dan Sharp is and about the series.
I'll tell you about the series first, because that's the easiest to answer. Dan Sharp is a gay dad. He's in his 30s when the series starts. He had, one miscalculation with one woman on one date and ended up with a son, but he never really intended to set out on a straight life of any sort, or even a bisexual life of any sort. But he knew he, as soon as he heard that she was pregnant, he knew he wanted to be a father. So he's a missing persons investigator. So people come to him, especially with young people who are missing, because he seems to have a knack for teenagers and kids and finding them. The series takes place largely in Toronto, where I live and Dan lives. Dan has a fictional house not far from my real house. We live in a neighborhood called Leslieville, which was kind of a low rent neighborhood for a long, long time, and seems to be coming up lately because the film industry has moved not far from this neighborhood, and that brought things to life. So that's the series. There are 7 books in total. The 7th one has just been released. That's Lionshead Revisited. Who Dan is a much harder question to answer. I mean, obviously, he comes out of me. He comes through me. He is somewhat me. He is somewhat my middle brother, my deceased middle brother. When Dan's sharp-tongued humor comes out, that's very much my brother. And my brother was a cop. So he saw the hard side of life sometimes. So he developed a fairly tough sense of humor. When I'm in the middle of a daydream and I hear Dan saying something, I think, no, that's not the way it should be. And I find myself arguing with him sometimes. So he's me, but he's kind of an antithesis of me in some way, and he's just a composite of many, many things. But we both share a core of belief in the salvageability of humankind, on any given day, both Dan and myself may say, why bother? The human race isn't really worth saving right now. But we always revert to, okay, but let's get going, see what we can salvage. So we both have that share that belief in redemption. The people are redeemable, and we still say, okay, you want to do it? Let's figure out how to help you do it. I do that with people I know. I took in a homeless person to come and live with me for a while. He was a drug addict. So I helped him, and Dan would do similar things to help people who say, I want to do better. And we will be there to say, okay, let's see how we can help you be that better person you want to be. But Dan's complex, there's not just one place or person that he comes from, I would say, overall.
Can you give us details about Lion's Head Revisited?
Lion's Head Revisited is the seventh book to be published in the series. It's chronologically the sixth. I tell people that after the first three books, the birth order got switched, so they refused to come out in the order that they should have. And there was a reason for that, which for two books in particular that I didn't quite understand. One was Shadow Puppet, which dealt with the serial killings of 8 gay men within the Toronto gay community. And at the point where I wanted to write it, the serial killings had stopped. So the story was kind of on hold. And it's not that I was writing the real story. I don't write real stories, but I'm inspired by real events, or I'm, sometimes so horrified by real events, I can't help having something to say about them. But in this case, it just seemed to be a story that started and went away, and so I left it. But when it picked up again was exactly when I started to pick up with the story again, around about 2016, I believe. And I finished the book and handed it in to my publisher, Dundurn, 1 month before the suspected and eventually convicted killer was arrested, and he eventually admitted to having killed all 8 men. Lion's Head Revisited was also delayed, and I didn't know why, but it had to do with summarizing the series. And the theme of the series is actually about fathers and sons. Dan has a son, he starts off at the age of 14, and by the end of the series, he's 21. But he has had major issues in his past with his father. So it's a father-son theme. But at this point, I felt like I wanted to put that a little bit in the background and deal with characters who were not male. So obviously there are going to be a lot of women in this book, and they become major characters in the book. And it was just me having a man fatigue in terms of characters. I just thought, no, I'm tired of these men always complaining about this and that. Let's give somebody else the spotlight for now. And the women came shining through, because they were really, really rich characters, and I really enjoyed writing them. And I had at no time in the book did I think, oh, I don't really know what I'm doing. I don't have the inspiration is flagging anything. I thought, no, this is really good. This is really something I can sink my teeth into and give it a whole new perspective. And Dan, of course, loved it as well, because he was, there is one male who is a client, but he gets tired of him very quickly as he tended to do in the last couple of books, because by then he was shaking his head and going, oh God, these guys, they really need to get it together. But suddenly this was a whole other field of, wow, okay, let's see what these women have to tell me to make my job interesting.
And there was no challenge writing from a woman's perspective?
Well, I suppose the readers will have to tell me that. I had written another book, which was published in 2010. It's called The Honey Locust. It's probably my most successful literary novel. It's about a female war correspondent who goes to Sarajevo during the middle of the siege of Sarajevo. And I loved writing her from her perspective, and she has a problem with her mother, and she actually goes to the war because it's easier for her to deal with things in a war situation than to have to come home and deal with her mother. So I didn't feel as though I had any problems with her or her two sisters. And readers who read the book, two things stood out to them. One, how realistically I portrayed the women, and they would often say, "How many sisters do you have?" And I would say, "I don't have any sisters." And the other was the detail of the war, and they would say, "How many times did you go to Sarajevo?" And I would have to say, "I didn't go to Sarajevo. I stood and watched it on the TV every night. I read books, I researched, I watched all the films, but I never actually went there." But it's interesting because it's about this woman and her two sisters. And my brother, Mark, the one who is deceased now, he read the book and he said, "Oh, that's interesting. You took you and me and our younger brother, Brian, and turned us into women." And I thought, "Oh my God, I did. I didn't actually realize I had done it."
I got to say, for the comments regarding the women and Sarajevo, that certainly is a testament to your skills. So that's quite impressive.
Thank you.
I've been watching you for so long now, got my eye on every move you make. I've been wanting you for so long now, think I might have made a big mistake. I try to leave each time I catch your eye when you're just passing by. I try to believe that you don't understand the kind of man I am. I've been wanting you for so long now, I try to make you feel the need inside.
In addition to everything else that's going on in your life, especially the music coming up in the next year, you have taken on something else that's new and exciting. Tell us about High Cotton Writers Retreat.
Oh, okay. Yeah, gladly. It's a project that I've taken on. I was asked to create a writer's retreat on an estate outside of Poplarville, Mississippi, a place I had never been. But I had been to New Orleans many, many times. And while I was there, I kept staying at a place called the Lion's Inn. I loved it. I still love it. But what made it particularly shine for me was the couple that ran the inn, one of whom was an older Southern gentleman named Floyd McLam, and his younger British partner, Stuart. And the two of them, Floyd was, you know, very talkative and very warm and open, and he had a largesse about him. He just lit up a room when you were in it. And Stuart was very very prim and very proper, and you know, everything was done particularly in a certain fashion, and it would always be done to perfection. But it was the combination of the two of them that made the place shine. So when I set the fourth of the, we haven't talked about this, but the Dan Sharp books are serious mysteries, whereas my earlier mysteries, when I first came to mystery writing, they were comic mysteries, and they're all set in gay resorts, the Bradford Fairfax mysteries. So the first one was the P-Town Murders, then Death in Key West, then Vanished in Vallarta, and finally Bon Ton Roulet, which is set in New Orleans right after Hurricane Katrina, which is when I first came there. So having been so inspired personally by Stuart and Floyd, I actually set them as minor characters in the book and dedicated the book to them, as well as to another couple, Paul and Greg Heron. I'm sure many of your listeners will know Greg, the author Greg, and his partner Paul. So I sent the book off to Floyd, and he was tickled pink. And the next time I saw him, he said, "Y'all know I am a rich man, and I do not want to die a rich man, so y'all can help me out by setting up a writer's retreat on my estate." And I thought, "Floyd, I can help you with that problem, no, for sure." So no doubt about it. So So since then, and that was about not quite a year ago. So since then, I've been setting up a retreat for him with younger, less experienced writers. But it turns out that most of them have had a book out by the time the retreat's going to happen. And but literally, we're looking for people who are wanting mentorship. And to that end, I've contacted Felice Picano. He's going to come down and spend a week with us as well. Felice Picano from the Violet Quill. And he's going to mentor these younger writers. And we're all just going to, you know, hang out in the swamps of Mississippi and have a great time and be inspired and to write our hearts out while we're there. So that's the writers, the High Cotton Writers Retreat.
And I've looked at the website, highcottonretreat.com, and I got to say it looks absolutely beautiful. So an incredible setting. You're lucky that kind of fell in your lap.
Oh, very much so.
So kind of along the same lines, what are some common traps for aspiring writers?
The first is put your ego aside. Very few people write a masterpiece on their first book. So put it aside and say, let's see what I've accomplished. You might want to try giving it to friends. Make sure you understand where they're coming from. Don't ask for advice if you don't know where it's coming from, because you could get all kinds of crap advice. But don't think that just because you sat down and finished a book, it's going to be the masterpiece of all time. You may sometimes have to write a second and a third book until you go back and see, oh, here's what I did wrong. Now this book is ready to be seen, to be read, to be published. So don't get hung up in the first book or even, you know, the first writing you do. Hang on to it and see where it leads you. In terms of mystery writing, I find that one of the common failings of writers, even some of the most accomplished writers, and I think it's because some of us get lazy at some point, is the psychology of the characters. I very often read a book and I just think, I don't believe that character would do that or would say that. You need them to do it because you need it to further the plot. And that means you've been lazy about creating your plot. So back up, fix the plot, and then make the character do something that they will do. Don't let them do something that nobody believes, because that's, for me, that's the kiss of death. Mm-hmm. So those are a couple of things.
Remember, I remember everything you said. Remember, I remember everything you did. Well, I remember every little thing we used to do. Well, I remember the times we used to walk in the park, making love on the sand, lying in the dark.
So now it's time for, as you're aware, since you've listened to the show, Awkward Questions Authors Get. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to spin the wheel, the magic wheel. And when we're done, we're going to hear what your question is.
Okay.
So here we go.
All right. I think I can hear the wheel spinning. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I can make the sounds before I put it in later.
Okay.
Here's your question. Where do you get your ideas?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me something really hard. Where I get my ideas, that's not awkward at all for me, because I know exactly where I get my ideas from. Some of them, the major ideas. I am a travel freak. And when I'm traveling, whether it's on an airplane, in a car, train, I kind of zone out. And, you know, I'll see something that stimulates me visually and I'll think, oh, who lives in that little hut over there? Or, you know, who's in that fishing boat way down on the shore? And what are they doing? And what are they thinking? And what motivates them? I'm endlessly curious about human beings, human nature. So my mind is always asking questions, even when there's nobody there to pose them or even nobody there really to answer them. But I like visual stimulation. So that it just, it just fires my imagination to no end. So, which is why a lot of my books are set in locations where I don't live. It means I've traveled there. And as with a lot of my mysteries, I tell people that's just my vacation with a murder thrown in.
And you actually just got back from vacation.
I did.
Yes. I've been watching your pictures in Facebook and been quite envious of your trip.
Well, come with me next year. I go to Mexico almost every year, sometimes twice a year. I like to go to the Atlantic coast for the Mayan ruins. I can't get enough of those. And then I go to the other coast for, you know, just to ruin my life and drink too much and lie in the sand.
Well, I've been to Puerto Vallarta once and had an incredible time. Now another awkward question.
Uh-oh, is this really an awkward one?
It kind of depends on you.
Okay.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how weird are you and why?
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay. That doesn't embarrass me in the least. I'll just let you know. People can't see if I'm turning red or not. I'm actually not. I think you would have to ask my family members. They would probably rate me kind of high. My friends who would say, well, he's not as weird as we are, but thank God he hangs out with us. I think people are unique rather than weird. There's black and white unique, and then there's technicolor unique. And I would say I'm technicolor unique. I guess because I've come to a point in life where I'm not afraid to be me. I was quite repressed when I was growing up. I didn't talk about myself. I didn't let anybody see myself because I thought I was very strange and nobody would understand and all those, you know, horrible teenage things that we go through. And then I grew up and I thought, no, you know, there's some pretty strange people around and I'm, you know, I'm maybe par for the course. I'm not terrible strange. I think I'm interesting strange. So that's why I say unique. So.
Would you say some of the awkwardness is part of the reason why you spent quite a bit of time in theater?
It's interesting because I went to theater school and looked around at all these would-be actors, and I thought, oh my God, these people are so messed up. And I thought, no way, I don't want to be like these. I'm going to stick with my original plan of being a writer. Well, eventually I thought, no, writers are definitely the weirdest of all the artists. So it backfired on me.
Well, and I think I agree with you on that one. This is probably my last question. If you could go back in time and tell little Jeffrey one thing, what would it be?
Oh, yes. Something I still have to give myself a pep talk for now and then is believe in yourself, even if nobody else does, because nobody else can make you believe in yourself. So you have to believe in yourself to keep going. And I think that's the key to longevity in the arts. I have a friend, Ingrid Matheson. She's a violinist and she's around my age. And we were talking the other night and she said, you know why we are still doing what we're doing? And I said, because we stuck it out. And she said, exactly. Mm-hmm. So through the good times, through the bad times, you stick it out, you believe in yourself, and you just keep going because there's no other way to make it happen.
Well, it took me a while to learn that, but at this stage in my life, I can tell you, I agree with you 100%. So
great.
I need to put a little plaque on my wall to remind myself of that sometimes.
Yes.
But definitely a good response. Well, it's been a pleasure to have you on.
My pleasure as well, Brad. I've really enjoyed this.
I appreciate the time you've given and look forward to hearing what comes with your music next year and look forward to your next book eventually when that comes out.
Great. I look forward to talking to you again.
I've been watching you for so long now. Got my eye on every move you make. I've been wanting you for so long now. Think I might have made a big mistake. I try to leave each time I catch your eye when you're just passing by. I try to believe that you don't understand the kind of man I am. I've been wanting you for so long now. I try to make you feel the need inside me. I think sometimes I might come on too strong. To try to fill this empty space inside me. Why can't I see you're not the guy for me? That you're not really free. Why must I be so blind that I can't see? That you're just laughing at me. Come on now.